Welcome to More Life, the Reentry Podcast, where we explore the transformative journey of reentry after incarceration. I'm your host, Venkivia Garner. Each week, we bring you powerful interviews with experts in the field and the voices of those who have lived through the experience. Our mission is to bridge the gap between scholarly insights and personal stories by shedding light on the challenges and triumphs faced by formerly incarcerated individuals. We explore the latest research, policies, and practices while also hearing firsthand accounts from those who've been impacted. Join us as we uncover the realities of reentry, challenge misconceptions, and inspire hope. Whether you're a professional working in the legal system, a family member, an advocate, or someone navigating reentry yourself, More Life the Reentry Podcast is here to inform, inspire, and ignite change. All right. Welcome back to another episode of More Life, the Reentry Podcast. We are so glad to be here today with another episode in our current season. Today, we will be talking more about voting rights. We have a very special guest with us, Mr. Desmond Mead, who is the CEO of the Florida Rights Restoration Coalition. And today we'll be talking about voting rights, his personal journey, and more of the advocacy work that he is doing. So thank you, Mr. Mead, for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, to get into our conversation, I kind of wanted us to start with, can you share a bit of your personal journey and how it has led you to your leadership role in the Florida Rights Restoration Coalition?
Sure. You know, in August 2005, I was in South Florida and I actually found myself standing in front of railroad tracks, waiting on the train to come so I can jump in front of it. You know, at the time I was homeless, recently released from prison, unemployed, addicted to drugs, and I didn't have any hope. Didn't see any light at the end of the tunnel. And so I was ready to end my life, but fortunately the train never came. And so I end up crossing the railroad tracks, checking myself into a drug treatment program. And after completing that program, I moved into a homeless shelter. And while there, I enrolled in school. And part of my recovery efforts, substance abuse recovery efforts, were to just get engaged and to start giving back, being of service to others. And I quickly was able to getting involved with some nonprofits dealing with homeless advocacy. And my involvement with those groups led me to a movement that was just starting around felon disenfranchisement. And I quickly was able to join that movement as well, where I learned a lot about felon disenfranchisement and how it impacted me directly. And I moved up through the ranks real quickly and end up becoming the president of that coalition. And in 2011, I took the coalition and incorporated it and created a 501c3 in the state of Florida that dealt with the primary mission at that time was figuring out how to end felon disenfranchisement in the state of Florida. Eventually, we got to a place to where I was able to lead the efforts to place a constitutional amendment on the ballot through a citizens initiative to amend the state constitution to allow for the restoration of voting rights to people with previous felony convictions after they completed their sentence. And we were able to be successful in 2018 since passing that particular amendment, which at the time was known as Amendment 4, we've been heavily engaged in trying to make sure that as many as the 1.4 million people who were impacted by that amendment passing actually had the opportunity to participate in our democracy. While doing that, we kind of expanded our work, understanding that it was more than just voting to people who've been convicted of felony convictions, that there were other many collateral consequences that, you know, impacted people's lives. And so we expanded our work to being beyond working beyond democracy and really focusing some of our attention on economic mobility, as well as shifting a narrative around people with felony convictions.
So I know y'all have done a lot of work related to restoring voting rights. And I want to just take a step back and ask you, so what was the turning point that made you realize the importance of voting rights for formerly incarcerated or system impacted individuals?
I think there was a lot of turning points on that, right? I don't think it was just one particular thing. You know, first time is when I realized that Florida at the time was one of four states that permanently disenfranchised a person, which meant that, you know, once a person was convicted of a felony offense, that they actually lost the right to vote for the rest of their lives. And the other states were Kentucky, Iowa, and Virginia. And, you know, starting I started then to understand the impact of the felony conviction as it related to voting, right? And that was one. And then the other one was, well, and through that process, learning the history of felony disenfranchisement, because I never knew about it. And so when I started learning that, how that was a practice that was used in the United States, and primarily to diminish the newly gained political capital of African Americans that were at one time enslaved in this country, it took on an even heavier meaning and a heavier importance. But then a few years later, really seeing how the process worked in Florida, and how, you know, just a handful of politicians could actually have an influence on whether or not a person can regain the right to vote. And then thinking about how, you know, when it comes to voting, I don't think there's anything else that speaks more to citizenship, right? Nothing says you're a citizen more than having the right to vote. And how people like me, who lost the right to vote, was relegated to second-class citizenship status. And so the other point came when realizing that a handful of politicians with a signature on a piece of paper could determine who's an American citizen and who's not, right? As it relates to being able to vote. And then I think the last turning point that really helped me fully understand the importance or the significance of being able to vote was just engaging with people throughout the state of Florida, right? And learning firsthand the level of despair people were having for not being able to vote, and how many people just really just yearned that opportunity to be able to be a part of something, realizing that, you know, that there's no other time more significant in this country that a person is made to feel like they're not part of something more than during elections, right? Just because you have a felony conviction, you're not excluded from participating in Halloween or Christmas or Valentine's Day, you know, or even celebrating the 4th of July or whatever. But the one time that's most pronounced is during elections. And that's when people are being told that, no, you're not good enough. You could pay taxes, you could do all this other stuff, but you know, you're not good enough to have a say in how your community, your state, or your country is governed.
So with that, then you go on this movement towards the Amendment 4, and you get a lot of success from it, actually the passage of it. How did it feel to see the successful passage of the Amendment 4 and restoring those voting rights for the individuals that have felony convictions in Florida?
1.4 million of them, I tell you what. And it was an amazing feeling for a couple of reasons, right? At least a couple of major reasons. One of them being that, you know, folks thought that an issue such as restoring voting rights to people with felony convictions was such a divisive issue it was going to be impossible for us to garner enough support to get it on the ballot, much less pass it. And we got it on the ballot. And when we passed it, I mean, that just surpassed anyone's wildest expectations. And so being able to accomplish the so-called impossible was great. The other part to that was, what I loved the most was the fact that we actually was able to do it in a way that did not contribute to the divisiveness, right, or the fracture of our country, right, and that we didn't use fear or anger or hatred to motivate people to vote for our initiative, but rather we use love as our focal point. And, you know, I tell folks a lot that, you know, we show the world that, you know, love can in fact win the day, that love can in fact be a driving force to bring about policy change. And that's what we did that. And then the last thing was that probably about 4 years before we were able to pass, 2 years before we were able to pass Amendment 4, I encountered a elderly gentleman who could not vote. He thought he could, but when he went to the polls to vote, they told him he could not vote. And when we inquired as to why, it was because he had a conviction for driving with a suspended license. And I remember when finding it out and looking at this gentleman, it struck me, because in my head, I was like, man, this guy is not going, he's going to die before he gets a chance to be able to vote again, right? And so when we fast forward 2 years later in November of 2018, right, when we passed Amendment 4, he was in the crowd at our watch party. And to have him cry on my shoulders and say how, you know, he can vote now, that was a very moving experience for me.
Definitely. I could just imagine that moment for him and for you. Yeah. So at this point, like you said, people are able to vote in Florida. And so Amendment 4 has passed. What obstacles still remain for people with felony convictions who are, wanting to exercise their rights to vote in Florida and maybe even beyond Florida?
Well, so as it relates to Florida, our amendment basically restored voting rights to people after, and these are the key words, after they completed their sentence, right? And that was to include probation or parole. And after we passed Amendment 4, our legislature seized on that phrase, completion of sentence. And they decided that completion of sentence also meant the satisfaction of all legal financial obligations that was associated with the conviction. And because of that, the legislation was passed several months later that required people to pay fines, fees, and court costs and restitution prior to being able to register to vote. And so while theoretically we passed an amendment that enfranchised 1.4 million people, the reality is because of these obstacles, a little over half of those individuals still could not vote because they had outstanding legal financial obligations. And so that is a challenge that we face in Florida. In a couple other states, that there are similar challenges that people are facing, where legal financial obligations, or in the case of, say, Tennessee, child support that are in arrears can be a barrier to you being able to vote. but for the majority of states, the barriers is basically lack of education or lack of knowledge. And what I mean by that is that there are folks who are eligible to vote in several other states. As a matter of fact, probably around like 19 million people in this country who are eligible to register to vote who are not registered because they either think that they can't register to vote, or for a handful of those folks, they're intimidated to even try to vote because they've seen when similar people attempted to participate in our democracy, how they got arrested and charged with illegally voting.
Yeah, so there still are barriers that need to be addressed. And I wonder, I know the Florida Rights Restoration Coalition offers some resources for some of the barriers that you just addressed in your state. Do you care to talk a little bit about what those resources are?
Yeah, so when legislation was passed that created the legal financial obligation requirement, we immediately embarked on a two-track approach because within that legislation, it also well, the provision that allowed for the courts to either waive those outstanding legal financial obligations or convert them to community service hours. And so one of the tracks that we took was to create a program that would engage the use of attorneys that would donate their time to work with helping us research individuals and help make a determination as to what they owe, and then represent them in front of a judge with the request to have their legal financial obligations waived or converted to community service hours. So that was track one, our attorney assistance fines and fees waiver program. The other thing that we did was we fundraised around fines and fees and to raise money to help people pay off their fines and fees, because what we did not want to have happen was for someone to be forced to choose between paying their rent or mortgage or putting food on their table and being able to vote. And so we raised about $30 million, and we were able to pay out that money to help thousands, tens of thousands of people be able to have the ability to register to vote if they wanted to participate in elections.
Yeah, I know Florida has become kind of like a model state, especially for the movement of expanding voting rights nationally. And I know there's a lot of other movements going on, voting rights, even just expanding it regardless of incarceration status. My question is what advice would you give other states or organizations that are working to restore voting rights for formerly incarcerated individuals?
Well, one of the things that we see, whether it's in California, New Mexico, Minnesota, Louisiana, North Carolina, right? One of the things that's been consistent, and in those states we've seen over the last, I would say, 6, 8 years, a significant expansion in voting rights for people who've been impacted by the criminal justice system. And the thing that all of those places have in common was at the center of those campaigns or those movements that were successful, was that there was someone who was directly impacted there. And so we've often heard that, those who are closest to the pain are the ones that are often closest to the solution. And so we have like real life proof of that. With all of these successful campaigns. As a matter of fact, the only campaigns that were successful were the ones where directly impacted people were at the center of it. And so one of the main advice that I would give to folks that's seeking to expand access to the ballot box is to ensure that there's someone who's directly impacted at the center of their movement.
Yeah, absolutely. I went to a voting rights convening not too long ago, and it was just amazing to see all the directly and indirectly impacted individuals that were a part of the movement, because their voices are the ones that need to shine to make the most impact. So I guess that leads me to asking you, so what lessons from Florida's experience can be applied nationally in efforts to restore voting rights?
I think one of the main lessons that folks can take from Florida is that it's not enough to just win something, right? You also have to defend it, right? And we've seen it in criminal justice reform as well as voting. That, yeah, you can be successful into moving or creating a more equitable policy, but it also could be efforts after that, a backlash that undo the wins that you make. And so, and as you're moving forward towards pushing through policy change, you always have to keep in mind that you have to move in a way that allows you to be able to defend it after you're successful, or if you're successful, to be able to defend it. I think that's a main lesson. Another lesson is that understanding that even me myself, as a person that's directly impacted, I don't have a monopoly on the pain, nor do I have a monopoly on the solution. And so the more voices that you can get engaged in the process, the better. And when I'm talking about more voices, in Florida, it was extremely, Florida was the worst state or the hardest state to pass a ballot initiative in, where you need a super majority to vote yes on it. We were able to get support from all specters. It was a wide range of support that crossed political, ethnical, socioeconomic status lines. We had folks from all over, right? Even from people from different faith. And so it was truly a really inclusive grassroots effort that allowed us to be successful, which means that, in a lot of states, there's not just one type of person that's living in those states. Also understanding that in any one of those states, there's not just only one type of person that's impacted by even the criminal justice system. Understanding that we don't lose sight of the fact of the disproportionate impact that a lot of these policies have on people of color or communities of color. But we also have to recognize that more than just people of color are impacted. And the more inclusive you can become, the more the greater the chances are of being successful.
Absolutely. So just shifting just a little bit, how do we encourage formerly incarcerated individuals to reclaim their voices and become active participants in civic life?
I think first of all, you gotta let them know that they can. There's a lot of folks that don't think that they can. And when they don't think that they have a that they have a opportunity to vote, then they may create a certain level of apathy that was in a lot of cases is superficial. It's just a coping mechanism of not being or feeling that you're not a part of, right? Just to give a quick example. I know we hanging around, we trying to picked up on the team to play pickup game of basketball, and then the guy that don't get picked, you're like, I want to be a part of that anyhow, because they sorry, whatever. No, that's just a coping mechanism. They wanted to be picked for the team, but the pain of being rejected, the pain of being turned away, the pain of being told or having been insinuated that you're not good enough, could sometimes cause us to react in a way that don't speak to our true feelings, but rather it masks the hurt that we are experiencing. And so you have folks that would be extremely apathetic towards voting, but the main reason is that because they feel that they can't vote to begin with, right? And so being able to speak to that to folks, and then after that, I think that really, and this is not only just for formerly incarcerated or directly impacted people, but the same argument applies for everyone. And that is about really talking about, if you don't understand the why your the vote is so important, at least understand the fact, right, that if it wasn't important, there wouldn't be people trying so hard and putting a lot of resources in it to stop you from voting, right? And so the basic question is, if your vote didn't matter, then why are people trying so hard to stop you from voting, right? And so, and then also the last thing would be to really speak to the history, right? Oh, the sacrifices that our people have made, or people from all walks of life have made, just so we can have the right to vote. And when we're not exercising that right to vote, that's basically saying to all of those people who sacrificed for us that they wasted their time on us, right? And so we, I think part of the vote piece around voting is really honoring our ancestors, right, who before us made the sacrifice so we can be a part of this system.
Absolutely. So I also want to ask, in what ways do you think restoring voting rights or civic involvement contributes to better reentry outcomes for people who are leaving the carceral system?
Well, we know that research has been very consistent in saying that the quicker a person is reintegrated back into their community, the least likely they are to reoffend. Which means, you know, if when the person gets out, they're able to get a job, they're able to get safe and affordable housing, they're able to vote, right? Like, no, you are a part of this community. You're not, we're not excluding you from this community. Once you help create that comprehensive sense of integration back into the community, it does have an impact on recidivism rates. And then on the other side of the spectrum, you know, being able to vote also creates leverage for you to actually move policy issues that have an impact on successful reentry. And so being a voting member of your population, you could help talk to or to get elected officials to see the importance removing barriers to housing and employment and education. As a voter, you have a louder voice than as a person that don't vote. And we know politicians are either going to listen to the person with the money or the people that actually turn out to vote, right? And so voting can, like I said, on both aspects, it inherently helps create an environment that will reduce the likelihood of recidivism. And it also can help change an environment through policies because of the leverage that you will have as a voter.
Absolutely. And I know you've already spoke to this a little bit, but I was just hoping you can expand or reemphasize it again of what role do system impacted people play in the broader fight for criminal justice reform?
God, I mean, they're the ones that's been leading all of the big wins that we've seen, right? I mean, at the end of the day, I mean, you know, could you imagine a man leading the women's rights movement? You know, that just doesn't make sense, right? And so when you're talking about a lot of the work that we're doing around criminal justice reform or expansion of voting rights, you know, it's only natural that the person who was impacted actually are the ones that's leading that or at the center of it. And not just for their stories, but also for their strategies and for their level of commitment, right? Because when, you know, I know in my personal experience, there were a lot of people in orgs that at, you know, in the beginning was very supportive of rights restoration, voting rights restoration. But you know what? If other issues popped up, they may walk away and now, you know, focus more on other issues. And they could rightfully do so because they have not lost the right to vote. They can get up the next morning and vote. But with a person like me, I couldn't, right? And so I had no choice but to stick and stay, right? I had, you know, and that's a level of commitment that I had because I felt the pain every single day of my life, every single day. And so which gave me a little bit more motivation to ease that pain or to get rid of it. When if a person is not experiencing pain, they're not as motivated to get that aspirin as a person that have the splitting headache.
Absolutely. That makes a lot of sense. So what are the Florida Rights Restoration Coalition's current priorities and goals moving forward?
Well, definitely, of course, you know, right up there at the top is voting, right? But we also understand that, you know, especially for those who may have been incarcerated, that as they're getting ready to get out of prison or whatever, they're not like getting excited and saying, wait a minute, no, I can't wait to get out so I can go vote. You know, that's not necessarily their number one priority. Their number one priority is about, hey, where am I going to live? You know, am I going to be able to get a job? You know, things of that nature. And so we also are focusing on removing the barriers to successful reentry, especially what we say is really helping to stimulate economic mobility, right? And within that economic mobility piece is, you know, getting occupational licenses, getting decent paying jobs, being able to further your education. And then, of course, being able to obtain safe and affordable housing. And so that's a bigger bucket in our arsenal now, as well as continuing to work on changing a narrative that a person is not shouldn't be defined solely by the worst mistake they ever made in their life, and that person with felony convictions is somebody's son, daughter, mother, father, uncle, auntie, and that we're still human beings that deserve to be treated with some type of dignity. And then that doubles down for people who've done their time, right? That once you've served your time, you should be deemed as having repaid your debt to society, and you should be afforded every opportunity to operate just like any other citizen within that society.
So I got two last questions for you then. How does this vision and what you all are working towards impact the broader community? And how can people get involved, whether they want are directly impacted or allies?
Well, I mean, first and foremost, I think that a rising tide lifts all boats. And so there is a direct impact that the community has, at its very basic element. There's a phrase that says that the hungry lion is going to eat, right? And so somebody's released from incarceration and they can't get a job, they can't get housing, they can't get education, and they're ostracized from the community. Chances are, guess what? A hungry lion is going to eat. And so you increase the likelihood of that person probably even being forced to feel that the only other option is to engage in some other type of activity, right? Criminal activity. And so that's at its most barest form. But then when you look at it from another perspective, there's opportunity that if people are able to have access to the things that will facilitate successful reentry, it doesn't just benefit them and their family. It benefits society as a whole. If I'm able to make money, I'm able to pay my fair share of taxes. If I'm able to buy a home, right, I contribute to revitalizing an economy, right? If I'm able to get occupational licenses and get the great paying jobs, then I'm able to spend more money, right, within that society, right, and to help really create a more robust economy. And so while the population in general, those are concerns, everybody's talking about the economy. Well, one of the greatest contributors to the economy that is not given the opportunity to contribute to the economy are people who have been impacted by the criminal justice system, right? There's about 7 million people in Florida that has some type of arrest record, and when you have a conviction, you can't buy a house, right? It's hard to buy a house, right? We know that according to the National Realtors Association, that when anyone buys a house, it pumps in about $122,000 into the local economy, right? And so if you stop and you just do just that basic math, right? Not the economist math, but just do regular math that we learn in school, that if every time a person buy a home, $122,000 is poured into the local economy, then what happens if just 1/6 of the 6 to 7 million people in Florida, right, is able to buy a house? Well, what I do know is that if a million people in Florida is able to buy a home, that pours, over $120 trillion, not billion, but $1 trillion into the economy. Everybody benefits from that, from me being able to buy a house. And so it's not just, oh, let's just treat people who made mistakes bad and let's continue to punish them, which that in itself is wrong because punishment shouldn't be continuous. It should be into the punishment, right? But it's not about just treating people better. It's about engaging in practices in which everyone could benefit. And that's one of the many ways that, everybody benefits, man. Just for me, just being able to buy a home. Just that simple.
And I think the last part of it is how can people become involved, whether they are directly impacted or allies?
Yeah, there are organizations throughout the country that work on similar issues. It all depends on the state that a person is in. I know, particularly in Florida, Man, folks can always like go to our website. We have everything there on our website or on social media. All they have to do is you can just Google Florida Rights Restoration Coalition, or you can go online at www.floridarrc.com, floridarrc.com. And then on the national level, like I said, there are so many different organizations within the respective states that are out there. But one national organization that has a lot of ties to those organizations are formerly incarcerated and convicted people and family members movement, FICPFM.org, FICPFM.org. And there should be links on that website that allows people to click on their respective states to see organizations that they can connect with, collaborate with to create a better world for everybody.
I will make sure that I put those resources in the box, in the description box, so people can access them. Well, Mr. Mead, thank you for coming on with us today and having this conversation. Before we get off of here, is there anything that you want to leave the audience with?
Yeah, I think that one of the things that I've been really heavily pushing over the past several weeks is just really just to be really conscious of the language that we use. You know, if you notice, I have not used that F word in this conversation, because people should not be defined by their worst mistake that they made ever in their life, right? And that word is such a dehumanizing word. That, you know, a person with a felony conviction is, like I said, someone's relative, someone's loved one. They're still a human being, and no one should be forced to wear that scarlet letter of shame for the rest of their lives. And so how we talk about people, whether we're using the frame justice impacted people or returning citizen or formerly incarcerated persons or someone with a felony, whatever terminology we use, we should lead with a person's humanity first, not with their mistake.
Absolutely. I agree with that. Thank you for reminding us all of that as well.
Thank you.
Well, look, I'm glad that you joined us today. And if you want to learn more about Florida Rights Restoration Coalition, I will make sure that I put the information in the description box, as well as the link for Desmond Mead's page as well, if you want to learn more about the work that he is doing. We do thank you for listening, and thank you, Mr. Mead. Thank you for joining us on this episode of More Life, the Reentry Podcast. We hope today's conversation has provided valuable insights and inspiration for your own journey or the work you're doing to support reentry. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe, rate, and review our podcast. Your feedback helps us reach more listeners and continue to bring you powerful stories and expert opinions. For more resources, updates, and to connect with our community, please follow us on Instagram and Facebook at More Life, the Reentry Podcast. If you have any questions, suggestions, or would like to share your own story, feel free to reach out to us at the email provided in the description box. Remember, reentry is a journey, and together we can make a difference. Until next time, stay inspired, stay informed, and keep moving forward. This is More Life, the Reentry Podcast, signing off. The content shared on More Life, the Reentry Podcast, is for informational and educational purposes only. The views expressed by guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of the podcast. While we strive for accuracy, content may be based on research, personal experiences, or opinions. Research is subject to change as new data emerges, and content may also vary from person to person. This podcast does not provide professional advice or recommendations. Listeners should consult with appropriate professionals for guidance. Please note that some discussions may also have sensitive topics, therefore, listener discretion is advised. This episode of More Life, the Reentry Podcast is funded by the Paul Simon Democracy Award. We thank you for supporting our mission to bridge the gap between scholarly insights and lived experiences.